Chapter 4. Plaza del Mercado. The way NSO co-founder and CEO Shalev Julio liked to tell the story, he was already in bed, asleep on Christmas Eve 2011, when he received his first ever personal call from a world leader, the president of Mexico. Actually, even when Shalev first revealed the story years later in an unprecedented and exclusive interview with a reporter of his choosing, he didn't name the country. He was forbidden, by contractual obligation and national security imperatives, to identify his clientele. But anyone with an interest in the world of cyber surveillance knew the man on the other end of the line had to be Felipe Calderón of Mexico. "I was informed in English that the president wanted to talk to me," Shalev explained. "I was sure my partner, Omri Lavi, was pulling a prank, so I said, 'Do me a favor and let me sleep,' and hung up. After the president's office realized they couldn't reach me, they called Saki, the project manager, who was more awake and agreed to take the call. The president of the unnamed nation said he wanted to thank us on his behalf and on behalf of his country, and that I couldn't have asked for a better Christmas present. With what you gave us, we can finally eradicate the cartels." The story was classic Shalev, self-effacing and self-aggrandizing all at once. A humble brag of epic proportion. Yes, he had been stupid enough to blow off the president of one of the world's largest democracies. But the message was delivered nonetheless. "You, Shalev Julio, have given us hope. With the help of NSO's novel Pegasus spyware system, the Mexican federales and the Mexican military finally had a chance to bring to heel the violent and powerful drug czars who held sway over much of the country's local government and police force, not to mention much of its national economy." Shalev first offered this fantabulous tale to reporter Ronan Bergman in 2019, as one of the early plays in a media offensive Shalev claims he undertook, grudgingly, to protect the honor of his unfairly maligned company. Accusations that Pegasus had played a role in the assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi were affecting company morale. "We decided long ago that we would not respond to anything. No matter what happened, we would not respond. And this worked out fine," Shalev told Bergman. "But now, for the first time, our staff have been coming to my office and saying, 'Look, we're upset, because we know the truth.'" They wanted him to tell their truth. So Shalev insisted to Bergman, on behalf of his beleaguered staff, that NSO Group was a force for good in a really scary world. "In the past 6 months alone," he said, "the company's products aided in foiling several very big terror attacks in Europe, both car bombs and suicide bombers. I can say, in all modesty, that thousands of people in Europe owe their lives to hundreds of our company employees from Herzliya." The story of the Calderón call and of NSO's heartsick staff and of the heroic feats accomplished by Pegasus were of a piece. First of all, these particulars were very hard to check in 2019. The head of Felipe Calderón's war on the cartels was just then being publicly accused of taking bribes from the drug lords he claimed he was trying to eradicate. So the former Mexican president wasn't picking up his phone to talk to reporters. NSO employees were effectively muzzled. No European police official was willing to go on the record, admitting that they licensed and operated Pegasus spyware. Then, too, Shalev's recounting of the NSO story was filigreed with fine little narrative gems. And they were exclusive. Which meant that while the stories were often too good to be true, they were also too good to leave entirely untold. or to leave for another writer to tell instead. So even really good and well-informed reporters such as Berkman, and a few others, would just put them in quotes and add a clause or two of their own to serve as the written equivalent of an arched eyebrow. The already harried NSO press team did have to occasionally do some cleanup in the aftermath of a Shalev interview. The boss was not well-versed in the technical specs of the Pegasus system, or the intricacies of high finance, or the fine points of the laws and regulations that governed the cyber surveillance industry in Israel and abroad. But he did exhibit a genius for controlling the narrative. Shalev Hulio, it must be admitted, tells a very good story. His story of the origins of NSO may be his best. It starts out as kind of a buddy movie, starring him and his best pal, Omri Levie. They were both born around 1980, into the false hopes that followed the Camp David Accords and the Israel-Egypt peace treaty, and raised with the whiff of peril always in the air. Between 1993 and 1995 alone, there were 14 separate suicide bombings in Israel, leaving 86 dead. They were similar boys, smart enough, but undisciplined. Shalev and Omri met in the mid-1990s while both were studying arts and theater at a high school in Haifa. After Shalev washed out of a program for gifted students because of congenital misbehavior. Both completed their compulsory service in the Israeli military and then some, though neither had served in the elite counterintelligence force, Unit 8200. Shalev and Omri remained in touch and passed through their late 20s together. The two men spinning hard to make themselves machers in the hottest industry in Israel. Shalev and Omri sometimes described themselves as serial entrepreneurs or early adopters of technologies. Roughly translated, this was two guys in a bar dreaming up ways to cash in on the newest computer tech. They weren't particular about the particulars. You could almost imagine them in that bar, as the sun was setting over their city, a pair of ambitious but unsettled young men aglow in their own joy and enthusiasm. While having drinks in Haifa, Shalev says, the two hit on an idea for allowing consumers quick and easy access to merchandise they had seen on TV or in movies. A shirt, a watch, a motorcycle, whatever. They even managed to scare up enough cash from venture capitalists to mock up a demo using scenes from Sex and the City. Click on Carrie Bradshaw's pumps, or her bag, or her dress, and Shalev and Omri's platform identified the designer. Manolo Blahnik, Fendi, Halston Heritage, and where to buy it for yourself. The idea was excellent. The timing was not. They tried to sell it in the teeth of the 2008 financial meltdown and ended up being squeezed out by VCs. You can't be an entrepreneur without being very optimistic, Shalev explained to Berkman. We said, okay, that happened. Let's move on. They moved on to a startup company called Communitake, where they helped scale a new software program created by a couple of their old Haifa schoolmates, one of whom had served in the Israeli Army's renowned Unit 8200. The innovation aimed to solve an emerging tech issue, a conundrum with a maddening feedback loop. When Communitake was founded back in 2009, the growing capabilities of mobile phones and the growing number of mobile apps available were vexing the growing number of mobile phone users. That is, the regular folk who were trying to benefit from these new technologies. Didn't matter if their phone was running Android or iOS, or was a Nokia N95, an iPhone, or the then popular BlackBerry. The problem with all of them was too many bells and whistles, too many options. There was a surfeit of smartphones and a dearth of smart users. Frustrated cell phone owners found themselves waiting in long queues on tech support call lines. When they finally did get a technician on the line, it was like the two sides were speaking different languages. which meant the calls were about as satisfying for the tech gurus on the other end of the line. To the horror of the tech support crew, even simple issues were rarely resolved in just one conversation. Repeat callers swelled the volumes on helplines. The mobile carriers found themselves hiring support staff at alarming speed, from around the world, and chafing at the increasing costs. Communitake offered a simple and elegant fix. They designed a program that allowed the support technicians to take charge of the phone. The phone's owner simply clicked on a link and gave the techies on the other end of the line complete control over the device, by remote. The experts didn't have to talk anybody through the process of, say, changing their ringtone. They just did it themselves. The end users were happy, or at least happy until the next complication arose. And, as time is money, the cost of tech support fell for the carriers. Everybody was happy. Communitake thrived, and still thrives today, having expanded its business into services like multi-layer encryption for securing all the data we now have on our phones. But according to Shalev Julio, Communitake was missing a very big opportunity back in 2009. A European intelligence service heard what we were doing and approached us, Shalev says. "We saw that your technology works," they told us. "Why aren't you using this to collect intelligence?" Shalev didn't understand at first. He thought they got all they needed from the carriers already. But the government intelligence pro explained that, no, they were losing visibility into cell phone communications of potential terrorists and criminals because of advances in encryption. Apple's new iPhone had been a disaster for law enforcement. The European officials told Shalev and Omri that the situation was grave. Here were the exact words they used, according to Shalev. "We are going dark. We are getting blind. Help us." Shalev and Omri didn't have to be asked twice. Not in Shalev's telling. They went straight to the Communitake board of directors with a proposition to provide a cyber surveillance tool for legitimate law enforcement agencies. The board said no. Communitake wasn't interested in the intelligence gathering business. It would require an entire new team with new skills. But Shalev and Omri didn't let it go, because they just kept fielding calls from anxious European intelligence and law enforcement agencies. "We were approached several times and asked, 'Can you do it without the user's permission?'" Omri later explained. "So we lied and we said, 'Sure.' We didn't understand at the time that this was considered one of the holy grails of the industry." The two buddies, they were early adopters of technology, weren't they? Decided this chance was too good to pass up. So they parted company with Communitake, with the blessing of the board of directors. News that the pair had raised $1.6 million from one of Israel's most successful venture capital firms did not alter the prevailing sentiment at Communitake. The development of cyber surveillance tools, Communitake's chief executive explained, came with a very real danger of casting a shadow on our company. So Shalev and Omri started a whole new startup, a half-hour drive from Tel Aviv, in an abandoned outbuilding. "Apple started in a garage," Shalev sometimes joked. "We started in a chicken coop." The two partners quickly added to their renovated chicken coop a recently retired Israeli military officer who specialized in intelligence, Niv Karmi. They named the company NSO, like America's NSA, with its top shelf cryptographers, right? For Niv, Shalev, and Omri, and registered it with the State of Israel in January 2010 as NSO Group Technologies Limited. Niv had the coding chops, and he also had some insight into Israeli counterintelligence operations and bureaucratic processes. The Israeli Ministry of Defense would have to okay the export of the sort of offensive cyber surveillance system they were engineering. The crucial task, when Niv Karmi came on, was to find that digital holy grail, to design ways to gain control over a cell phone surreptitiously, without being invited in by the owner, and without the owner's knowledge. The counterintelligence specialist had few qualms about prying open a back door to a private cell phone, if it enabled law enforcement officials to track terrorists and criminals. "Look, I'm Israeli," Niv explained in an interview with Die Zeit at the end of 2021. "All of the risk that I grew up with first as a child, and then in the service, was a life threat. And for us in Israel, everything is about saving life." Niv Karmi lasted only a few months at NSO, and his memory of that time does not always align with Shalev's. Particularly, the story about all those requests for help from the many unnamed European intelligence officials. "That's not exactly how it happened," he succinctly told Die Zeit. "In the beginning, there was a vision to do something good with NSO," Niv explained. "I was quite fresh out of the service. In the service, everything was about vision and what you want to do. And then I got in with these two guys that were very business savvy. For me, there was a clash of dialogues. They were more business driven, with a different view on how business should be built or handled. NSO, minus N, was about to die another unheralded startup death when, according to Shalev, he was in a coffee shop and overheard some young engineers talking about a friend of theirs who had developed the technology to hack cell phones. Shalev butted into the conversation. "Let me buy you a coffee, because I have to talk to you." The engineers agreed to introduce him to their friend, a personage Shalev has refused to name. "Scrawny guy, plaid shirt, glasses, a lot of pens," is how Shalev generally describes him. Miraculously, as Shalev would have it, the scrawny hacker in the plaid shirt pulled NSO's chestnuts out of the fire. It took a year, but by the spring of 2011, Shalev and Omri had a product to take to market. "They called it Pegasus," Shalev says, "because what we built was actually a Trojan horse we sent flying through the air to devices." Claudio Guarnieri was just then starting on his own personal trajectory in policing cyber intrusion. Bored with life as a corporate IT drone at 23, he had taken a job as an internet security researcher, trying to identify new cyber surveillance tools and call out their purveyors. The focus of cyber forensic specialists at the time was the hunt for spyware aimed at desktop computers and laptops. While the cyber defenders bent to the task at hand, Pegasus flew right over their heads. "I think NSO was the first company that was solely focused on one thing and one thing only, which was mobile," says Claudio, looking back a decade later. "At the time, that was a bit premature, but I think that they were seeing that that's where the market really was going to be. And also, on the defensive side, the mobile platform had been left behind. From an investigative point of view and from a forensic point of view, it allowed NSO to be unchallenged for much longer. NSO not only stumbled onto the right technology at the right time, they also found the perfect marketplace. Or, shall we say, the perfect Plaza del Mercado." If a startup spyware company wished to go bowling for dollars in 2011, there was no better place than Mexico. The lights in the alley were on 24 hours a day, and there were plenty of open lanes, because President Felipe Calderón was already 5 years into a ferocious battle with the Mexican drug cartels. Calderón had called for a war on the drug lords during his campaign for presidency, and he acted on that call in his first week in office, in December 2006. The new president of Mexico sent 6,500 troops into the fight and quickly expanded the combatants to include more than 20,000 soldiers and federal police. Calderon did not waver, even as the death toll mounted. Almost 7,000 Mexicans were killed in 2008 alone. That was the same year the United States decided to join its neighbor's fight, sending military and law enforcement agents to Mexico to help coordinate. Better than that, the Americans poured money over the border and into the newly minted Merida Initiative. The U.S. Congress appropriated $1.5 billion to aid Calderon and his fighters over the next 3 years, which meant that even after the Mexican military and police forces upgraded their weaponry and hardware, there was plenty left over for the latest in digital technology, malware capable of monitoring and tracking the cartels and their abettors. Procurement officers from Mexican military, law enforcement, and intelligence agencies had real money to spend on cutting-edge spyware tools. NSO was a little late to the first frame of the contest. A handful of Israeli tech companies had already closed deals for spyware in Mexico, as had Gamma Group, based in the UK, or Germany, or the British Virgin Islands. It was hard to tell. Hacking Team, the presumed world leader in this blossoming field of cyber mercenaries, headquartered in Claudio's hometown of Milan, Italy, also had its sights on this spectacular and spectacularly complicated market. For a new and uninitiated private cyber surveillance vendor like NSO, simply deciphering the tangle of Mexican government acronyms could be head-spinning. The Secretariat of Home Affairs, SEGOB, oversaw two enormous and growing agencies in the market for cyber surveillance tools, the Center for Investigation and National Security, CISEN, and the Federal Police, PF, as well as subcategories in each, like the PF's Sensitive Investigative Units, SIU, operated in partnership with the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. Then there was the Office of the Mexican Attorney General, PGR. The PGR had a thin budget for cyber, but as the agency that prosecuted all federal crimes, was constantly on the lookout for what one lip-smacking European cyber surveillance developer called lawful hacking opportunities. And finally, there were the big dogs with the big budgets. The Mexican military's growing intelligence agencies within the Army, SEDENA, and the Navy, SEMAR. This alphabet soup only accounted for the federales. There were also 31 separate states, plus the Federal District of Mexico City. So law enforcement agencies in Puebla, Tamaulipas, Yucatan, Durango, Jalisco, Baja California, Guerrero, and the state of Mexico were among those with an interest in licensing spyware. The NSO team was fortunate to find just the right guide through the maze of La Plaza del Mercado Vigilancia Cibernética. A man known as Mr. Lambo. He favored expensive Italian roadsters, or El Chino. He was of Japanese descent, but close. Jose Susumo Azano Matsuda. Azano is a Mexican citizen, born and raised in Jalisco, where he joined his father's business. Jose Susumo Azano Moritani, the elder, was a civil engineer by trade and a doer by temperament. "Try to be so great that everyone wants to reach you," he would say. "And so humble that everyone wants to be with you." He gradually expanded his business from the manufacture of bathroom tiles and metal fixtures to metal roofing and then to industrial-size construction projects. When Susumo Azano Moritani died in July 2021, obituary writers credited Grupo Azano with having built major factories or retail centers for Nissan, Honda, Ford, Walmart, Kodak, and the electronics firm Selectron. The company had also won lucrative government contracts to manufacture license plates. All this made the Azano family one of the richest in Jalisco by the end of the 20th century. But what had really swelled the Grupo Azano bank accounts, into the billions it was rumored, was its entry into the electronic surveillance business in 1998. Security Tracking Devices, SA-DeCV, didn't itself develop spyware systems, but acted as the middleman for the cyber surveillance companies. These private companies were all foreign-based, so their ability to negotiate the cultural intricacies of the Plaza del Mercado really depended on having a Mexican company to act as sales agent. El Chino was an ace. Security Tracking Devices, STDI, quickly became Susumu Ozano Matsuura's favored baby, and he had raised it into a plump and happy adolescence by the time NSO came to him about marketing Pegasus in Mexico in 2011. The company's revenues were tending toward astounding, thanks to an expanding pot of war on the drug lords money supplied by Mexican and U.S. taxpayers. STDI sold almost $400 million in equipment and services to the Mexican military in a single year, though none of the deals were disclosed to the folks who had paid for them, which is to say, those taxpayers. The company was like the technology it sold, a ghost floating silently in the background, maintaining, as Azano put it, a constant presence behind the scenes. Earnings from Mexico allowed STDI the resources to market the newest spyware systems throughout Central and South America, and to open offices in tax-friendly Singapore and in the world's tallest building, the Burj Khalifa in Dubai. The UAE was fast becoming, as one of Azano's few confidants explained, the new hub for this type of business. The profits also allowed Azano and his wife to purchase a waterside manse near San Diego. He liked to fly his private jet up and spend a few days a week in his posh American digs, where he was busy scheming ways to make illicit and illegal campaign contributions to a local mayoral candidate. He expected, in exchange, a little assistance in the oceanside retail and residential development he hoped to build there. Earnings at STDI also gave him the resources to strong-arm one of California's major natural gas suppliers, called Sempra, for the land where he wished to raise that development. Azano was a very complicated man to bring on as a business partner. According to public reports, law enforcement officials in the U.S. and Mexico had, at various times, suspected Azano of bribery, money laundering, tax fraud, and drug trafficking. He would later spend 3 years in an American jail for the illegal campaign contributions in San Diego. Is this a guy who could be trusted with military secrets? I wouldn't trust him with my laundry, said the former U.S. attorney in San Diego who prosecuted that case. This is a sophisticated businessman, adept at finding ways to circumvent the law. But in 2011, when Shalev and Omri were doing the vetting, Azano could still point to a clean bill of health from prosecutors on either side of the border, and a go-pass from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and U.S. intelligence officials. Also in his favor, if you were looking at it from Shalev and Omri's point of view, Azano was an avid and unapologetic proselytizer for the cyber surveillance industry at large. He was happy to push back against the voices, especially in the U.S., who worried about the erosion of civil liberties. For the average citizen, the cell phone now serves the purpose of both tracker and wireless data collection devices, as well as the less important function of the phone, Azano wrote in his personal blog. It is the perfect tool for a society that has come to depend more and more on surveillance, whether we like it or not. The government, it should be noted, did not hand out smartphones to American citizens and demand they keep detailed logs of their every move. Americans did that to themselves. People were excited about doing it, constantly seeking new ways to advertise where they were, what they were doing, and with whom. Can people really blame governments and advertisers for taking advantage of their actions? Or do people accept that these are the repercussions of naivete and a nation caught up in a love affair with new technology? Azzano saw the potential of NSO, this new entrant into the intrusion-as-a-service industry, right away. STDI reportedly paid NSO $500,000 for the exclusive right to resell its Pegasus technology, and Shalev armed Azzano and his team with a set of talking points to take to potential customers in the Mexican government. That document is a perfect little snapshot of the promise of NSO's earliest technology, which was ambitious right from the start. The Pegasus system, according to this document from 2011, provided a tactical, active approach for breaking through the wall of encryption built into the most common mobile phones on the market, BlackBerries and Androids. These devices, the NSO talking points lamented, had become a secure and convenient method for communication for all kinds of criminal activities, which is difficult to monitor today. The Pegasus system offered a soup-to-nuts solution. The first step was injection, finding a vulnerability in the phone's operating system that opened the door for Pegasus users to surreptitiously plant the spyware on the phone. Step two was configuring the software so it could successfully monitor, collect, and prepare all data for retrieval. This data included all contacts and calendar entries, all email, voicemail, and instant messages, all system files, as well as current and past geolocation. The earliest Pegasus system, according to the talking points anyway, had the ability to remotely turn on the microphone to monitor environmental voice interception, which is to say any live conversation within earshot of the phone. It could also remotely activate the mobile phone's camera for capturing snapshots. Step three was data retrieval, wherein Pegasus would exfiltrate the contents of the phone and place them in one of the end user's servers, ready for archiving, mining, and analysis. The Pegasus system, as offered, included NSO-provided hardware, software, maintenance, and training for the various sorts of operators needed across the platform. There was an array of infection vectors to choose from, each tailored to a target's device and operating system. Front-end consoles, where government-paid operatives executed the initial infection and configured the Trojan horse malware for monitoring and the exfiltration. Anonymizers, to hide the end user's real IP address and camouflage its activities on the internet. Firewalls and virtual private networks, VPN, for added security and convenience. And rackable servers for storing the growing mass of data retrieved from the targets. As a rule, NSO figured 2 terabytes was a good starting point, enough to monitor 400 different mobile phones at 50 megabytes of data retrieved per target per day for an entire year. But NSO also encouraged Azzano and his team at STDI to assure potential buyers that this cluster of servers can grow with the customer future needs seamlessly. NSO technicians would do the entirety of the initial setup, maintain the hardware, upgrade the software as needed, monitor the system in real time for any malfunction, and be available to troubleshoot. They would also train the ops who worked on the front-end consoles. For the attack and configuration agents, NSO recommended local people with degrees in criminology, anthropology, or psychology, an ability to provide unique insight into target psyche, and to work under pressure in non-standard hours. End users could count on up to 6 weeks of dedicated time from NSO talent to get the system up and running and the operators properly schooled. NSO looked good to Azano, another sluicing river of income for STDI. Azano, meanwhile, looked good to Shalev and Omri. NSO's new reseller provided instant intelligence in Mexican commercial traditions. Mr. Lambo, for instance, was schooled in the operative custom of mordida, the bite, knew which officials in the chain had to get a cut of any big sale, what size cut would be deemed acceptable, and how to make sure it was safely and secretly dispersed. Azano also provided connections. He knew the generals who made the final decisions at Sedena, the admirals at CIMAR, the supervisors at CSEN and the PF, and the top prosecutors at the PGR. Azano's contacts apparently went all the way to the top, to the office of the president, to Felipe Calderon himself. On May 25, 2011, just weeks after Azano signed on to market NSO's spyware system, Shalev Julio got an email from one of his NSO operatives. "Mr. Azano notifies me that the demo to the Secretary of Defense and the President will take place next Friday. They called me after confirmation, and they asked me to do my best to be there on Tuesday, since the Secretary of Defense requested a demonstration the day before, Thursday, and for the President on Friday." Neither Calderon, nor his SecDef, nor Azano himself has confirmed that the scheduled demo actually happened. But 6 weeks later, in July, STDI closed a deal with Sedena, the first major sale in the history of NSO. The contract was reportedly worth a little over $15 million, which, more or less, launched NSO as a viable company. When Shalev finally told the story of that first deal, not long before Forbidden Stories and the security lab got access to the leaked data, he didn't dwell on Azano, who was at the time in a U.S. prison, and STDI. He talked about the general he met in Mexico City and the assurances the military man gave Shalev and Omri about the way their powerful new cyber surveillance tool would be used and all the good it would do. The country had decided to establish a separate new body, a branch of the military, to deal with the drug issue, Shalev remembered, in another of his uncheckable stories. This body would include spotless individuals with no history of corruption who would undergo a polygraph test. "Then we met with the general, the head of that branch. He said, 'You fit us like a glove. We will base our entire drug-fighting apparatus on your new technology.' This is how the biggest situation room, not just in the region, but one of the biggest in the world, will fight crime and drugs. And to them, we agreed to sell." Shalev always wants to make it clear that NSO was a company that took seriously its first principles right from the beginning. Sell only to government agencies and never get involved in their operations. Vet those agencies to make sure they will honor human rights and civil liberties, and adhere to the laws and regulations of Israel. NSO does all of that, Shalev Julio insists to this day, and he sleeps very well. But there is an insider at NSO who recently, and accidentally, gave us an interesting insight while offering sympathy for the kind of new and underfunded spyware enterprise NSO once was. "We've evolved with time. We are a big company, making enough money so you know we can say no to a deal," the insider explains. "But if you're a small company and you are struggling to pay a salary to your employees, and you have $10 million coming from a state in Mexico, you know, you don't really think about human rights. That's just the reality."